Hi, my name is Alex Ford, and I'm here with Mrs. Edith Hubbard. It's October 22nd, 2015, and we are at the Carolina Club in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Hi.
To start out, could you tell me a little about your childhood?
I'm a North Carolinian, a native Tar Heel, born and bred. I was born in Dunn, North Carolina, and then very shortly thereafter, we moved to Durham. And so I grew up in Durham County, bordering Orange County. So we had a Chapel Hill address most of my growing up years.
Okay. Can you tell me about your family a little?
My mother was a nurse. My stepfather worked as... did custodial work at the university. He did a side business of custodial work, cleaning, and that sort of thing. I have one brother, younger, 6 years younger, and a sister who is almost 9 years younger. I have two children. Five grandchildren and one dog and a husband.
Thank you. What was it like growing up in Durham?
Good. I think I had a very happy childhood. I had good friends. My best friend growing up was a neighbor. Her name was Elizabeth Alexander, and her mother was a ballerina, and Elizabeth couldn't dance, and I couldn't dance, so, but we did. We spent most of our summers together. We had dolls, you know, and the typical, you know, growing up things. And they moved away during my high school years, so I just sort of lost contact with her. But growing up was good. We had church. Lots of good things. So, childhood was good.
Thank you. Was anyone else especially influential at that point in your life?
Oh, I had lots of good influences. At the time I grew up, we were in a segregated school system. So, I got lots and lots of special attention. And I think teachers, when they recognized that a student had potential, they nurtured that. They challenge you. We had opportunities. Probably my busiest extracurricular activity ended up being the YWCA. So I went to YWCA camp all over the state. I was in a leadership role during, you know, the summers, and participated heavily in YWCA growing up. I sang in the choir. I think that had something to do with my mother being the pianist, and you're going to do it. But I enjoyed that. Growing up was good.
Can you remember any experiences you had in the YWCA?
One summer we were going up to Camp Tacoma, and in a station wagon, I think, with four other girls. And it was a long trip leaving Chapel Hill, Durham, to go up to Camp Tacoma up in the mountains. And about midday, there was some discussion about, with the other girls, you know, we're hungry. And the director, the driver, who was not the director, but, you know, one of the head counselors, prolonged stopping for as long as she could. And then everybody just got real insistent, we're hungry. And so she stopped. And I remember her saying, well, why don't I go in and get us something and bring it to the car? Which was perfectly logical and normal to me, but not to the other girls who were very accustomed to going in. And it ended up that she had to explain to the girls that I was not allowed in, and we were going to get the food, but we're going to eat it in the car. And they were annoyed, and I think rightly so. But I remember being struck by that. I remember being very struck by that. And because I had a very sheltered life. Things like that, that could have been, I think, very stinging. She handled, I think, with a great deal of wisdom and grace. But that kind of racism was very prevalent. But in many instances, I had been sheltered and was oblivious to it. So I remember that. And I remember thinking that was one of the reasons that the why was so important to me.
Thank you. So you've already mentioned this a little, but could you tell me what school was like for you when you were a child and also when you attended high school?
I was considered gifted. And so we got, and I think there was about a class of 18, and we had accelerated everything. And so high school for me was wonderful. I do remember running for city council against a very dear friend, Charles Day. And it was a very, very close race. And Charles beat me by one vote. And the one vote was mine, because my mother had always said, you show grace by voting for the other person. And I did. I voted for him, and he didn't vote for me. So I remember some lessons, while very noble, can bite you. So, yeah, I really enjoyed school. I can't think of any really, really bad experiences I had. I do remember that while I was in high school, it was the height of the civil rights movement, or maybe the beginning, you know, that was those early stages when there were picket lines. And I just had a tremendous need to participate. And so after school, I would stop off in Durham Walk on the picket lines. And at that time, our neighbor was a barber on Federal Street. And so I always had a ride home. And so I could do that. And I remember one day I'm on the picket line in front of Woolworths in Durham. The building is still there. And it was, you know, there were a lot of picketers, protesters. And I remember this man just sort of coming out of nowhere. And he put his cigarette out in my hair. And because we were taught to be nonviolent and not to, you know, do any confrontation, some of the other protesters just pulled me away, got me out of harm's way, brushed my hair, and took me back to the church. We were at St. Joseph's Church at the time. And I don't think I remember being angry, but just really confused. And I'm still confused by that kind of hatred. I don't think you ever come to understand it. It's just there. And I was one of the fortunate ones because there were so many others who were beaten and, you know, so I was fortunate. And being kind of small of stature, people readily wanted to protect me, which is, you know, a very good thing. I remember that. And I remember my neighbor, who was friendly with the sheriff's department, coming down and saying to my parents, they thought it would be a good idea for me not to be involved in that kind of thing. And I remember my parents saying, you know, we don't really want you to do this. And I remember pleading my case, and I remember my parents saying, well, we've told you what we think, but if that's something that you really think you want to do, okay. And I took that same tack with my children. I would say, I don't know about this, but if this is something that you really are committed to doing, okay, but voicing my reservations, but always giving them the option to reach. And I think that served us all well. So,
how old were you when you were picketing?
I was 15, and I went to college when I was 16, so that was my senior year, and that was in 1962, because I started college in 62, and that was my senior year.
And do you remember if y'all were picketing a certain thing?
That was during the sit-in demonstrations, Woolworth, bus boycotts and all of that. So, and then, you know, coming back to Chapel Hill, talking about picketing, when I came back to graduate school, the cafeteria strike was in full swing. And I had a car. And I was asked to go pick up Floyd McKissick because he was going to speak to the cafeteria workers in the cafeteria. And I went and picked him up and brought him on campus. And my job, my task was to escort him into the building. And walking up the sidewalk of Lenore, there were a solid line of highway patrolmen with bayonets, you know, the bayonets on the, and we walked past that, and while it was just maybe the distance of Lenore Hall to the door, I think that was the longest walk of my life. Nothing happened, but to this day, I can close my eyes and see our highway patrolman standing with bayonets in a solid line on this campus. And that was a cause that I was deeply committed to. And then talking about cafeteria workers, when I was here as an undergraduate, I ate in Lenore, and all of the cafeteria workers were Black. And so going through the line, I always got more than enough. And when I got to the end of the line, that was my time for seeing people who smiled at me, who kind of knew what I was going through. And sometimes I would be in Lenore and I would sit down, and the people at the adjoining tables would get up and move. That has changed. So, but, you know, I think that's a part of the history of our transition from the old way to a far more progressive and civilized way of behaving. And now you look at the campus and it's beautiful to see Black students, white students, Asian students, Indian students, everybody together. And there is no hostility or animosity. We have become what we were supposed to be. And I think that's the thing that I'm proudest of for our university. We have grown to treat all people with mutual respect. That I love about my university. And I think that's one of the reasons that I chose to stay, because this is a state university. It's funded back then primarily with taxpayer dollars. Yet, it was limited admission as to who could come. And given the fact that taxpayer dollars paid for that, I figured I had as much right to be here as anyone else. And so I just kind of refuse to give up that right. And so my thing was, I'm going to stay here. And so I stayed. And I'm so glad I did, because in some small measure, that was a one of the first steps toward what we have now. And I like that. I smile every time I'm on campus and I see it. You know, you go and it belongs to everybody. And that's such a great feeling.
Thank you. So how did you make the initial decision to come to college in general and then UNC specifically?
Actually, I didn't. I went to Bennett, and my junior year, the president, Dr. Willoughby Player, said, I think you need to live in the president's house, because some students lived in the president's house, and those were students that she's considered to have high academic potential. I don't want to do that. And I pleaded and said, you know, I really don't want to do that. Can I just? And so she said, no, if you stay here, you will live in the president's house. And so my thing was, I don't want to do that. And so a real good family friend, William Darity, said, "Well, you know, you should apply to the university." So I said, "Okay, what the hell?" And I applied. And in those days, it was a black and white photo, so you could fudge it a little bit. And I got an acceptance letter. So I went to Dr. Player and said, "You know, I've been accepted here. If you could just see your way not to making me live in the president's house, we good." And I should have known better. Dr. Player says, "No, my decision stands." And I was so sure that she was going to relent, but she didn't. And I certainly couldn't. So I said, "Well, I'm going." And so I came here totally unprepared, even though I'm from Chapel Hill. I had been sheltered and loved and coddled in high school and at Bennett. And when I got here, it was like, "Why are you here?" And that was hard. The transition here was hard. First, I didn't know anyone. And my first semester here, I had an English class in Bingham. And I went to class, and I sit on the front row because I wear glasses and I don't see well, so I need to see. So I always try to sit on the front row. And so when class started, the professor said, "You have the wrong class." And I took out my little notebook, looked at it. The building, the day, the class, everything was. And so I said, "No, this, I'm supposed to be here. This is it." So he said, "No, you're not." And he essentially said, "You know, you're not going to make it." And I think something clicked in my head because I remember saying in very colorful language, "If I don't make it, nobody else in this class is going to make it." And there were two professors here, associate professors. One of them was Leon Rook. And for all of the assignments that I had, these two professors agreed to review them and, make suggestions. So, I think the work was good, but I never got a real good grade. I got a C out of that course. And the only saving grace with that C is I brought the curve down, because if you gave me a C and the next semester, I think the university chose to offer him some more options. And I think my confidence would have been shattered had I not had the support from other faculty members who knew that I could do it, knew that I had done it, and that really boosted my confidence. And when I came back here for graduate school, fast forward, race for some of us had taken a back issue, and then there was a woman's issue. And I'm in graduate school, and I'm taking a course, and the professor, and we're graduate students, he's going around. There was a nun in the class who was absolutely fabulous. We're going around and we're saying who we are and why we're here. And at that time, I was a military spouse. My husband was in Southeast Asia. And so I introduced myself. You know, I have two children. My husband is in Southeast Asia. And I'm here working on my master's. And the professor said to me, well, you're just taking up a space that a man needs. And there was just sort of dead silence in the room, like, and so the nun, because I was in shock, the nun said, well, let's just see how it works out. And that mentality is still, I fear, somewhat prevalent today, that men are supposed to have the opportunities and the privileges. But it just amazes me that people have the audacity to articulate it. It just amazes me. And that was, 1969. And go figure.
So, thanks. Why did you decide to come back for graduate school after feeling isolated as an undergraduate?
Economics. My husband actually suggested, you know, that I find something, you know, interesting to do. And so I said, oh, I'll go back to school. And I got in because I really didn't expect to get in because it was at the 11th hour. But I got in and you're in, so you got to do it.
Was that experience any better since it was a few years later? With a different crowd, maybe?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it was much, much, much better. There were more black students on campus. The black student movement was well-formed, high membership. There were a lot more black students on campus. And the atmosphere had changed. There wasn't this open hostility. And I knew more people. So, you know, I had matured. The country had changed. The country was changing. So, yeah, that was a lot easier, so much easier. But again, when I came here initially, I was a fish out of water. I was totally unprepared for the isolation. So,
did you ever say anything back to that professor or anyone who got up and moved? Did you ever say anything against people who were treated?
Well, the people who got up and moved, no. What you gonna say? But to the professor, you mean in my English class? That's embarrassing because, yes, I did. And it's too colorful to say again. But suffice it to say, even I was amazed at the four-letter words that came out. I was amazed. And I wasn't confrontational. And I think now, some 50 years later, I'm not confrontational. But I feel strongly that I have a moral obligation to speak up, and I do that. But that was, I had to grow into that. But I'm firm now. When you see an injustice, you have to speak up. You have to take a stand.
Thank you. I'm interested, how did you find those professors who helped you with your coursework and everything? Were they other professors that you had, or did they approach you?
The good thing about Carolina, in when I was here as an undergraduate, there were some marvelous, marvelous professors. There were professors who were not racist at all. And I truly believe that those who were in the minority. And I would dare say today, that sort of behavior is almost non-existent. But back then it was a different time, a different social climate. And so now I think it's, I know it's much different. There are just some things that will not be tolerated. And I think the university has been open and receptive to all kinds of diversity. And so, again, for that I applaud the university. We are growing with the times, so that makes me happy.
Thanks. And just something I was curious about, why didn't you want to live in the president's house at Bennett?
I don't know how much you know about Bennett College, but Bennett College is a women's college. And back then, you were expected to behave like a lady. You wore your pearls, your gloves, and you behaved appropriately. And alas, I was a free spirit. Sometimes colorful language came out, which would have shocked her. And that was just a pressure that I just didn't want to, I didn't want to conform, I guess. And I, looking back, I think she saw potential that needed to be corralled and molded. And I just wasn't ready to be molded. And to this day, she is truly one of my my idols. She was the sort of lady, if she had a meeting, now you gotta remember the times, we're talking in the 60s. If she had a meeting with a potential donor, before she would get whatever she was wearing wrinkled, she would walk 16, whatever it took to get to the meeting so that she would be pristine. She is the only woman that I know where I never, never saw a strand of hair out of place. She was immaculate at all times. She was composed at all times. She was an amazing woman. I mean, just absolutely amazing. In hindsight, I probably should have stayed there. But I think I had other callings, so. But she truly was an amazing woman.
As a woman at UNC in the earlier times when they first started admitting women, did you have certain rules that you had to follow here?
No. I mean, no, I just went to class. got the assignments in.
Did you live in a dormitory?
No, I lived off campus.
Okay. So what subjects did you study here?
I was a psychology major, and because I kept getting mixed signals on what I needed, what was required to graduate, I took everything. I mean, you know, I was, oh my God, I need this. Oh my God, I need that. And so I ended up graduating with a double major because somehow, in order to make sure that I had what I needed to graduate, I had taken enough credits to qualify as a double major. So I ended up graduating with a double major. Initially, back to where I stayed in Whitehead, you know, for a while during orientation and that, but that proved not to be a good mix for me, so I lived off campus.
Were any students friendly?
Oh, yeah. Not very many females. And I can see why. I mean, you know, because it's conformity. And so, no, I had very few white female friends. I did have good friendships with the black male students on campus at the time. There were seven of them, and oftentimes we studied together, and that was helpful. I also had another good friend, Charlie. And Charlie had multiple sclerosis, but was brilliant. And so Charlie and I developed a friendship, and he was a good study partner. We had the same courses, and we ended up, you know, graduating together. I was gun shy. Charlie was my main friend, and then there were some of the women who were active in the black student movement, I think my senior year. And I think I was friendly with some of them. But for the most part, it took all I could do to study and keep my head above water.
Were you involved with the NAACP or the Black Student Movement on campus at all?
Yeah, both.
What sort of things did you do with them?
There were demonstrations. The Black Student Movement's primary focus at that time was the cafeteria workers. And so there was heavy involvement with that. And then there was some protests. But I did not have a leadership role in that. I was an active member.
What do you remember about the food worker strike? Any incidents or anything like that?
I guess earlier when I talked about the incident with the highway patrol and the bayonets, that was probably the most vivid thing that stands out in my mind. The cafeteria workers' strike was the cafeteria workers' support was probably an ongoing thing because the administration just did not want to move on that. And so that is the thing that I think stands out most in my mind. The Black student movement did bring on campus Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, and a number of others. Okay. And I remember Johnny Mathis performing on campus. And the reason I think I remember that is because I think they were looking for some Black students to go with him to dinner or whatever. And so I got asked and I went, met Johnny Mathis. That was wonderful. That was wonderful.
What about the town of Chapel Hill in general? Were they receptive of you? Were restaurants receptive of you?
I was a student, honey. You don't go. The hangout for my group was the Rathskeller. So sometimes, you know, you'd have meetings at the Black Student Movement, and then we'd all go to the Rathskeller. Other restaurants, not as an undergraduate, but we did almost all of us go to the Rathskeller, and remember on a student's budget, a poor student's budget, you know, some things. I didn't eat out a lot, but I did eat out at the Rathskeller quite a bit, you know, in the evenings and stuff.
Thanks.
And then back to the town of Chapel Hill. When I was a graduate student, I lived in the Black community. And like I said, my husband was in Southeast Asia. And I had two small children. I was a graduate student. And one night, one morning I woke up and I noticed that the screen in my bedroom was cut. And I became nervous, talked to the police, and they said, you know, they'd patrol more. And then the next night, an 87-year-old woman was attacked, and they caught the perpetrator. And it turns out that that was who cut my window screen. And he said, well, yeah, he cut the window, and he looked in, and he saw this skinny woman with two small children in the bed, because that's how I studied. I put the kids in the bed with me, and then I studied. And he looked in, saw, and decided, well, that wasn't worth his energy. And then I decided, well, I probably need to move. And so talked to some of the students in the Black Student Movement, Juan Cofield, James Cofield, and some others. And so they said, okay. And so I went to Tate Realty and said, you know, I'm looking for an apartment. Do you have anything? And so they said, no, we don't have anything right now, but we'll keep you on our list. And so the next day, Juan Cofield sent a young white woman in who said she was looking for a place. And they said, oh, we've got right now. You can move in immediately. And so I ended up, with the assistance of the Black Student Movement, of filing the work. First open house discrimination suit in the country. Needless to say, despite the fact that we proved our case, we lost the case. And Roland Giddes, who was one of the town fathers, right after the trial was over and the judge had rendered his decision, called me in the back room and said, we're going to let you move into the apartment. And so I moved in with and stayed there for the duration of my graduate program. And what I remember, and the reason Roland Giddes had worked this arrangement out with John Cates, is because first we were the first open housing case filed in the state. While they won, it was very obvious what was going on. And so I moved in, and for a while it was just not a happy scene. Jesse Helms did a commentary on I needed to do better things than be involved in filing a suit. And so we did that. So I'm sort of a backgrounds person. I could have chosen not to do that, but I did. I'm glad I did. And that's one more sort of issue that we've pushed a little bit further down the road. And then I came back to the university to work after saying, oh, but when I graduated, I said, I will never give this university one dime of my money. Never, 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 never. But I've grown since then. I'm a member of the Carolina Club. I'm a lifelong Tar Heel. I'm a lifetime member. I support my university. Because I see it's capable of growing and change. And so it is not the place that I came to. And so I love it. I love everything about it. I'm happy I was in the place that I was to come here. I'm hoping my having come here has been a small part of the change. So, the university and I have a history.
Do you wish that UNC had done more as an institution when you were a student here and when students were integrating in general?
Oh, absolutely. But I also realize that somebody has to initiate change. And given the time, I was one of the tools. And in my rebellion during that time, when I think the one thing that I deeply regret having done, when I graduated, and you know, you walk across the stage and they shake your hands and Luther Hodges was the governor. And I walked across the stage and I refused to shake his hand, only because of the cafeteria workers, the way I had been treated, not by him, but just the anger that I had. I didn't shake his hand. And he looked at me, you know, you have eye contact, and it was like, and on a human level, I knew I had hurt his feelings. And that always bothered me. I wish I had shook his hand. Because I can close my eyes now and see that look. And what I did to him was what others had done to me. And so I've said, I never want to do that again to another human, because I know how deeply it cuts.
Thank you. Do you have anything else you'd like to talk about?
I'm glad you're doing this.
Thank you. I'm glad you're doing this. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk with me. Yeah, do you have any other stories you want to tell or topics you want to cover?
To bring the race question full circle, when I was in graduate school and I had moved to I-10 Brookside Apartments, all my neighbors, of course, were students. One of my neighbors was oh my God, her name went out of my head. I think it was Frances. And she was the granddaughter of a former governor. And we spoke, we became friendly. And when I graduated, the first thing I had said I was going to do was get a puppy. And so Frances said, oh, I own a sire, and you can have one of his puppies, and he's a black lab, and he's champion material. And so I said, really? She said, yeah. She said, my aunt will probably have a heart attack, but it's my dog, you can have it. So we drove to South Carolina to pick up this gorgeous dog. And the aunt was very gracious. She gave us the runt of the litter, who turned out to be a gorgeous dog. And we named him Shaka Zulu Warrior. And he was just a marvelous dog. He went with us too. Texas, I think to California. Poor dog rode everywhere. And then we shipped him from Texas to North Carolina, and he was stolen. But Francis, who was, by all standards, a gentried Southern Belle, was a very dear friend. And what I know to be true, friendships know no color lines. And I wish more people could figure that out. I'm sure you can. I rambled, and I apologize. So, if you have questions that you want to,
you covered most everything that I had. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
So.